Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan, and welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. I've got two guests together today, and I'm just going to jump right into introducing them. And Bob, you're there.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi. Now, is Gina on a separate line? Is she talking with you?
I'm on the same line right here, Peter.
Oh, are you both loud and clear? Well, this is,
folks,
this is a friendly gathering here of folks who care a lot about what happens to people who are in the mental health system. Bob Nickel, and their last name is spelled N-I-K-K-E-L, and he's been on my show in the past, and so has Gina. Bob has got a master's in social worker, and he's executive director of a very interesting new program, the Mad in America Continuing Education Project. This is something I developed with Bob Whitaker, and it's to try to get into the medical education system where doctors and other people can get credits toward maintaining their license or maintaining their professional credentials by taking tests, by getting new information and usually getting tested about it. And mostly what's available is the drug company version of this. And so Bob Nickel is trying to introduce a whole new perspective into that field. Bob's background is really quite extraordinary. He was actually the State of Oregon's Commissioner for Mental Health and Addictions for 5 years up through 2008. He's a member of the Executive Committee of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health. He's generally just a lovely human being. Anybody would be delighted to have Bob Nickel for a friend. Gina Nickel can say the same personal things about. Gina is actually the director and CEO of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. Both people, by the way, teach and have credentials in the university system, both a husband and wife. She's worked in policy areas where I think she has her PhD in for many, many years in mental health, addictions, leadership, management. They both bring a great deal to this this foundation for excellence in mental health care. If any of you out there are just looking for a place to contribute money, this would be the first place I'd recommend. And welcome to the hour, Bob and Gene. I think, Bob, you were planning to start out, right?
Well, I certainly can. I would defer to Gina, but she would like for me to say a few words about my project, and then she'll tell you more about the foundation. And by the way, Peter, thank you very much for the kind words about us personally, professionally, and especially about the foundation, because the foundation, which Gina will tell you more about, is into about our fourth, fifth year now, and we're doing, I think, some pretty incredible things. The project that I'm leading, as you mentioned, is the Mad in America Continuing Education Project. And Bob Whitaker asked me to direct this a little over a year ago. And as you said, it's a project that provides online educational programs that qualify for continuing medical education credits and also continuing education units for professionals. We are working with the American Academy of Family Physicians for the continuing medical education credits and with an organization called Commonwealth Educational Seminars, which is based up in Massachusetts, to provide credentials for psychologists, social workers, licensed marriage and family counselors, nurses, and some of our courses have qualified for certified addiction counselors as well, although not all. So we now have about five or six courses up online. A recent change that we made was to open up the courses for people who want to take them and, in a sense, just audit them, and who do not want or who do not need continuing medical education or continuing education units. People can take these now for free, and I think that's a really nice step in the direction of getting more of this information available. And Dr. Bregan, as you mentioned, so much continuing education has been sponsored by or is the product of information produced with commercial interests. And one of the key things for us is to have absolutely no commercial profit interest at all in this. And the providers, the instructors that we have no ties to commercial enterprises in their current roles. So I think this is a very good step in an important direction. We're in the process of beginning more in the way of marketing. So one of the reasons people may not have heard about it is we wanted to wait until we had kind of a core group of courses available. And I think we're pretty much at that point now. So that's an introduction, Peter. If you have some questions or things you'd like to bring out, I can talk a little bit more and a little bit about the particular courses that we have.
Just tell me about whether it's looking hopeful that you'll actually become a voice that the more or less establishment can hear.
I'm hopeful. I think as people begin to realize these courses are out there, they realize that this is something quite different for continuing medical education. One of the first courses that we produced, for example, was Dr. Sandra Steingard, who's a real practitioner in Vermont, and she runs a real program, a community mental health program, and she's done the first course on what we call antipsychotics. If I may editorialize just a little bit, I'm not sure that we really should be calling the medications that are known as antipsychotics, a more generic, and I think more accurate term is these are neuroleptics. And, Peter, you've written about this for decades. But I was thinking this morning, these medications really aren't any more antipsychotic than a six-pack of beer. I mean, basically, they dampen down your entire sensorium. And I think we're becoming more and more concerned about the long-term effects. It's clear that most people who take antipsychotics or neuroleptics actually don't do as well in the long term. There may be a few people who need to take them short-term and long-term. We're not going to argue about that. But it's clear from the long-term outcome research that neuroleptics, for most people, are not necessary. On the other hand, as you've mentioned, pointed out in your books on psychiatric drug withdrawal, Peter, you can't just go off them. That's not that simple. So Dr. Steingard's course is a major step in the direction of really helping people understand what these medications are and what they really do, both short-term and long-term effects.
Well, you know, I think the term to describe them is they're lobotomizing agents. Because every one of them has its fundamental impact by rendering your frontal lobes, which is the seat of your soul, so to speak, less able to function. So people get more docile, and people may feel less. They may be less aware of what's happening to them. But by and large, even though people are really flattened by the drugs, the vast majority of people on them don't want to take them because they just make you feel terribly uncomfortable. But that's probably too hard a message for almost anybody who wants CME credits to stand. but I think that's what they basically do. And I'm really, really glad you're making inroads into getting more of that, more of the truth out there. Where would you like to go from there? Do you want to go on to talk some more about this program? Maybe tell people something about what I think is one of the great hopes in our field, which is your organization. Bob is on the, if I didn't mention that, Bob Nickel. And by the way, I don't know if I spelled it or not. It's N-I-K-K-E-L, Bob and Gina Nickel, N-I-K-K-E-L. Either one of you want to talk more just about the whole foundation?
Sure. Thank you, Peter. First of all, I'm really pleased to be on your show again. And I'm really glad, and I want to go back and talk a little bit more about the Madden America Continuing Education Fund, because I think people really should take the classes. You know, they're free for anybody that doesn't want the continuing education credits. And there's Bob has assembled a magnificent lineup professionals in the field are talking about different aspects of not only psychiatry, but the use of medication and what long-term and short-term use really means. This fund, like other funds within the foundation, are really designed to help educate people. The Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care was created in February of 2011, so we're about 4.5 years old. And it was created by a group of psychiatrists, psychologists, people with lived experience, social workers, public policy people that all had the same concerns. Basically, we read Bob Whitaker's book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, in April of 2010, and it concerned us. And we knew that we needed to have a conversation about what research actually says about psychiatric medication, what practices are out there that are hopeful, what practices need to be replicated, what we needed to do outside the bigger industrial complex as a people. And so the foundation was created basically as a community mental health development bank or a community foundation made up of you and I and thousands of people out in the world that all want to start asking these questions. Our mission is simply we connect the passion of private philanthropy with the world's top researchers and programs to bring recovery-based care to every community. You know, this includes the million-dollar donors, and this includes people that can only afford $10 a month out of their Social Security check. We have both kinds of donors, and what we do is we make sure that there are research projects and programs that underscore a recovery-based care, and we want to replicate that so it doesn't matter what your zip code is, that these services are available. I'll take a break and see if you have other questions before I go on.
Well, now, our center, the Study of Empathic Therapy, we have a relationship with you
yes.
in which we lend our name to you and you lend your name to our cause. Explain more to people how that works, because that's a part of
sure.
that community involvement that you're talking about.
Absolutely. So the way that our foundation is set up is we have a number of funds. So we're like a community foundation. We are a community foundation. We have donor advice funds, incubator funds, and general funds. And what that means is the general funds, people will just donate and not specify what they want it for. And that could go for general research, the board of directors, and our global scientific advisory committee that we have decide where those general funds go. Sometimes it might be for operating expenses. Sometimes it might be for educational symposia or general research. Then we have what's called incubator funds, and that is usually somebody that has a big idea that they want to become a 501c3 themselves, but they need somewhere to get started, and their projects are usually much bigger in scope, and they want to become their own business. And then your fund, the Empathic Therapy Fund, people can donate to. That comes under a donor advice fund, and we have 30 of those. And basically what those are is we have people come to us with good ideas all the time, and we usually test those out, you know, make sure that they pass the straight face test and that there's some scientific validity behind it. Other ideas want research behind it, and so we're creating those mechanisms in partnership with universities to research them. those are usually opened by a funder that says, for instance, in your case, the Empathic Therapy Fund supports research, education, publications, and conferences that foster caring, respectful human relationships. Somebody could go on our website, Peter, www.mentalhealthexcellence.org, and go on the donate button, and they could click and say, I want to give to the Empathic Therapy Fund because I want to see Peter do more conferences. And they could give money to that fund towards that. Or they could scroll down the list and give to a number of funds. We've got a lot of information on our website, and I think people would be very, very interested in the plethora of research projects that we are not only conducting now, but also raising money for, and the number of donor advice funds that really take a look at the wraparound services and the nurturing services. And I can highlight a few of those if you want, and so people can get an idea of the
Let's get to that in a second. I wanted to clarify one thing, which I think is really great, and I think I understand it correctly, which is if somebody in the listening audience has a really good idea for a foundation, for a nonprofit, basically, for a nonprofit, but doesn't even know how to go about or have the money to start a 501c3 so that you can get tax-deductible donations, you can get in touch with Gina Nickel and the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care and see if they are interested in what you're doing. And if so, then you can end up beginning to work as a nonprofit without having to go to the government yourself. You can go right through your foundation. Is that correct?
That's correct, Peter. Yes.
I think that's a miracle.
It is. Being a 501c3 is a lot of work, and we certainly want to nurture people that have great ideas, a business plan, and startup money, but don't know how to go about that. So that is one of the services that we provide.
Good. Well, I'm happy to have you dive into some of the projects that your foundation is supporting. They're cutting edge, folks. They're some of the best things that are out there. So just take off on that.
Sure. I'll highlight a few. You know, first of all, we highlighted the Empathic Therapy Fund that actually Dr. Peter Bregan, our host, and Ginger Bregan are the fund advisors for. In addition, a couple really, really exciting projects that we have is we have a fund called the Hearing Voices Research and Development Fund. And it was funny, for the first 3 years, most of the donations were coming in from the UK, from England and Wales, mainly because the Hearing Voices Network over in the UK works so well and provides such fantastic support for people. You know, they were donating it because they want to see the same thing in the United States. To that end, we just received a $250,000 donation from a donor who wants to expand the Hearing Voices Research and Development Fund in the United States. And so that's a fund that we just named five different locations around the United States that will be developing the Hearing Voices Network in those regions. Our goal is to have Hearing Voices groups available to anybody in the U.S., no matter where they live. So that's really exciting. And again, you know, donations to that fund would help expand those networks. Another project we have is Open Dialogue.
Sure. Gina, let's stop there for a second. The Hearing Voices, you know, some of my audience knows about that and some don't. I first came across the Hearing Voices group in Great Britain a few decades ago. And what's evolved over time is that a lot of people who, most of whom have been through the psychiatric, mill, who have been hearing voices, and very bad milk, and realize that it's just not the right approach, that to call them schizophrenic or to call them this or that and to drug them. And the Hearing Voices group is trying to give a lot of more validity as a human experience to the process through which really a significant portion of our population goes through of hearing voices. And I think the folks who are in that group vary probably across a big spectrum from people who are hearing voices that are very painful and agonizing, and they want to figure out ways to manage them, to overcome them, maybe to leave them behind, to people who basically are hearing more friendly voices and want to be able to share with people without being called crazy. But it's a wonderful group, and I try to cite them in my work when I get a chance to. I don't know if you or Bob or Gina want to add more to that, just so letting people know, giving a little bit more of a handle on what that group is.
Peter, one of the things that struck me in reading about it a couple of years ago was that I believe it was in London, there was a meeting that was called for people who were hearing voices to come to a meeting and just kind of talk about it. And 450 people showed up, if I remember correctly. 150 of them had never been to a mental health provider, which is interesting that it suggests that this is a much more common and in some ways normal experience than we've ever really thought about.
Well, surveys, really, they come up with figures like 20-30% of people, at least at one time in their life, have clearly heard a voice from outside their head addressing them or speaking to them. It is more common than people generally are, you know, want to admit, because nowadays that's considered by any emergency room doctor, general practitioner, or psychiatrist to be absolute evidence that you're crazy. And it may or may not go along with having problems in living and you know, having social issues or economic issues to deal with. But it is something that people across the board have experienced, and many, many famous people, from Joan of Arc to a lot of poets and fiction writers have talked about, you know, their voices.
One of our dear friends hears voices, and he does police training, and it's very interesting because the voices are not always fun for him. he talks to the police about hearing 17 different voices in his head, and he said half of them tell him that he's the greatest human being who ever lived, and the others tell him he's the worst human being who ever lived. And he really gets the police attention by saying that 16 of them are guys, and he said the 17th one's a girl, and he says she's really cute.
Oh, God. Well, you know, who among us hasn't struggled with whether we're superior or inferior, whether we're really very special or really not special at all? And, you know, to hear a bunch of voices telling you this, to me, isn't a huge jump from what goes on in any of our hearts or minds, and probably in every adolescent's heart or mind.
Yeah. And you can go on our website and read more. We have a whole list of fun. Another project, Peter, is called Open Dialogue. Open Dialogue was first created in Western Lapland, and it gets really, really good results. It is more of a model where services are wrapped around an individual and their loved ones and their connections. It works so well in Western Lapland that we wanted to replicate it in the United States. Obviously, Western Lapland has some demographics and geology there that we don't have here in the United States. They are more static. We move around more. And so we've got several projects in the United States that we support in looking at whether open dialogue can be replicated. And we're working with UMass because out of Amherst, University of Massachusetts, because obviously something that is that intensive, insurance companies don't like to pay for. So we are doing a project to create a fidelity scales and also a clinical manual to help insurance companies look at and pay for that and replicating that model. That's also a very good one.
Let's stop with each one, make sure we get to talk about each one individually. Is that okay?
Sure, absolutely.
We've got about 4 minutes before break. Open dialogue is, I think, brings the best there is together, which is really a family approach to helping young people in distress by approaching the whole family. And so what they do is they have a variety of professionals who come usually more than one at a time to intervene early on in the family and to help people communicate better and to express their caring for each other. And they have this wonderful phrase that schizophrenia lies somewhere in between the family members. And nothing could be more radical in comparison to psychiatry, which says it's, you know, in your genes or in your biochemistry rather than in your relationships. And I think it's a real breakthrough, and it's what I try to do to help people, but I just do it myself, which is whenever possible when somebody is having any kind of disturbance, if they're young, to actually insist that the whole family work with me. Because if you you heal a family, you heal the one who happens to have burned out from whatever is going on in the family. And even if the family isn't the major source of the problem, the family has the greatest healing power for helping young people. The family is by far and away has the greatest healing power. So I've always believed this going way, way back. Gina, Bob, I was the first person to ever do family therapy in Syracuse, in the mental health community of Syracuse. I was an intern at the time. But I've been reading about some of the early innovations in family therapy.
Well, Peter, I can really appreciate that because when I was a therapist way back when, before I became an administrator and did family therapy, that's exactly right. Getting the group together, you cannot help a person individually if the family is in crisis. And I think this model makes sense, and so we're really excited about replicating open dialogue, and that's one of our projects.
How far along are you?
We are very far along in creating the fidelity scales and the clinical manual. In fact, they are almost done.
What are fidelity scales, Gina?
Fidelity scales are what insurance companies use to measure whether a certain modality work or not. So it's all within the insurance industry, and their measurements of basically whether they feel that a person is being helped.
Yeah. You know, folks, one of the things about the Western Lapland, which, by the way, you can Google it by going to Open Dialogue. Open Dialogue is a good way to Google it. I think I have that phrase right, Gina.
Yeah.
And you'll get lots of information and lots of researchers who've published many articles whose names I can't pronounce. But and I'm hoping to meet someday. But it really does epitomize the cutting edge in the delivery of services, and it's really great that the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care is supporting this. We're getting near break. Let me see if my engineer's alert. We're working with a new engineer today, and we'll go to break whenever the music starts. You're listening to me, Peter Bregan, to talk to Bob Nickel and Gina Nickel, husband and wife team, remind me a little bit of me and Gingy, who are really, I think, as a couple, on the very, very frontier of doing all that's best in mental health today. And I sure hope you will continue to grow and to thrive. When we come back after the break, you can, we'll just pick up on some more of the projects you're doing and on anything else we want to chat about. Let's go to music. Hi, folks. It's me, Peter Bregan. I'm not sure what happened today. Usually there are ads and not ads, but, you know, stuff about the program during the music break. And I don't think you got to hear that. You got to hear a little bit more of Vangelis, who plays the music for my show. We are back quickly with Bob Nickel and Gina Nickel. Either one of you want to pick up on what we're talking about?
Sure. Let's move on with some of our other projects. And again, people can go on our website and look at the many, many projects and really get a good education about what they're about, and they can donate to them if they'd like.
Sure.
Oh, Bob wants me to give the address again, which makes sense. It's www.mentalhealthexcellence.org. That's an easier way to remember it, mentalhealthexcellence.org, because some of these projects, I think, really excite people. You know, one of the interesting things is we get calls all over the world from people that want more education, want more camaraderie, want to learn more how to help their loved one. And to that end, we have partnered with Christina Kennan at practicerecovery.org. And Practice Recovery and us, what we've done is create a whole curriculum called Families Healing Together. And they start on the 15th of every month. They're online. You can do it at your own pace. You can sign up. And then what's created afterwards that I've gone through the courses myself, they're excellent. And then there's a whole community that converses back and forth. So you can bounce ideas off each other, you know, what worked in your family. I tried this in my family. It didn't work. What can I be doing different? You know, after the training, that's very, very helpful to people. So that's called Families Healing Together, and we send notices out on our Facebook and on our website all the time. Any thoughts or questions about Families Healing Together?
No, not for me. Bobby, do you have anything to add?
Well, yeah, it's
a lot of the family education that's been developed has been done with a lot of drug company influence. And I don't want to be critical of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, but it's well known that they've had a lot of involvement in years past with drug companies. So a lot of the materials that have been developed there may have that kind of influence. This is an area that has had no influence from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, we intentionally developed it without that influence because we think that it's really important for people to learn the other coping strategies and mechanisms and supports that don't have those commercial and sometimes harmful effects.
The commercial influence right now, if you look at some of the web places, the pharmaceutical companies are still saying things like schizophrenia is a lifelong illness, and that's a quote. And that's actually not borne out in the research at all.
Yeah, I did a radio show recently with a director or a former director of a department of psychiatry, quite an outstanding figure in the field. It was kind of a little bit of a debate format in which this person took the position that schizophrenia develops in teenagers and adolescents not due to biochemical imbalances but to imbalances in the whole organization of their brain, and that has absolutely nothing to do, no mental disturbances have anything to do with the family. That's old-fashioned. I think about, well, what does that mean to some young person who comes who's feeling humiliated and feeling alien in the family and would like to be relating better and nobody knows how to go about it, and then the whole family is told this person is a schizophrenic and don't worry about it, and this person's labeled for the rest of their lives, gets no grasp of what's happening to them. I think it's a crime. I think it's just criminal what's going on.
One of the things that we have going right now within the foundation is a scientific advisory committee. And just this week, interestingly enough, some of the members have begun raising the question of what does this term schizophrenia really mean? Is that the best term? I'm taking a somewhat radical position suggesting that we stop using it, that it's caused more harm than good, and we ought to start rethinking everything without that as an influence.
Yeah, you know, way back in toxic psychiatry, I think I called it a psycho-spiritual crisis. That it's almost always has very deep challenges going on inside the person about what is life and who are they. You know, earlier we talked about, you know, am I the greatest person in the world or the least person in the world? It's all about place in the world, and one's identity gets really shaken, starts to fall apart. It's much, much more understandable in terms of that at an early stage of, you know, becoming a person, we lose our way for various reasons. And you lose your way in some pretty commonplace ways, you know, hearing voices, having ideas that are patently false, and things like that, and not knowing what reality is, what's really being said or not said. All these things happen when people begin to just come spiritually, and what they need is a loving, supportive environment to help them get themselves back together again. I don't think
absolutely that, Peter. That is so true, and that's one of the things that the Families Healing Together tries to support the family and give them family education about that. We also have classes called Recovering Our Hope for people that really have started losing their hope, because, as you know, the mainstream system sometimes doesn't give the love and care and support that people need, and they need to learn to navigate it and work with each other. So that's one of the classes that we provide. You know, one of the other things that I think is really important for people to hear is that some of our research projects. So, you know, to that end, we've had research projects with Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard, taking a look at what are the standards of prescribing practices and care for children. And this is very, very controversial, but we have two doctors out of Harvard that are really, really interesting in looking at a stepped care model for treating depression. And remember, these are diagnoses that the system has for us. So depression and ADHD in children, they're very interested, and they have done a critical review of existing and potential evidence, and we're doing it in a stepped care process so people can see what the research really says. And as you know, Peter, the research is not really great about the overprescribing that we have done as a society of psychiatric and psychotropic drugs to children. It really borders on, it's one of the biggest moral failures, I think, that we've had, at least here. I'll just speak to the United States. Don't get you started, right?
I don't know if you've seen my article in Childhood and Society, in which I describe some of the horror of giving drugs to children, and I actually call for a complete end to it. I say we have to stop giving psychoactive substances to children to control their behavior or their thoughts or their emotions or anything about that aspect of their lives. That's not what you do to kids. And I also call it child abuse, but not by the parents, who generally have no idea what's going on, but abuse by our profession and the pharmaceutical industry. And so I'm coming, the older I get, the more and more I'm just saying it direct. We need to just stop giving drugs to kids, period.
And
you
Peter,
don't have to agree. I'm not trying to drag you into a dangerous agreement.
No. It's not a dangerous place for me at all. I agree with you 100%. The issue is that, people go to med school, they learn one thing, they're taught one thing, and we have to make sure that we join the research that's actually out there and help people to understand that in a society we have gone to polypharmacy, we have gone to things that are absolutely, and I'm going to say it, ruining our society. And while some people would say that medications work to control children that really, really need it, I think those cases are probably few and far between. We are seeing much, much more damage done to children by giving medications that change their brain structure and basically change who that child is. We need to have much more discussion like we're having right now, so people understand that we've been sold a bill of goods by the pharmaceutical industrial complex. I'll just say it.
Well, it's very strong language, Gina, and I much admire your saying that, and I hope that there will be tons of people with the courage to keep supporting you, because I think it's time to stop mamby-pambying around with this evil that's going on now, where we are, as you said, we're changing the brains of children before they have a chance to find out who they are.
I
think it's just a terrible thing.
The other research project that we're doing, we're in the middle of several papers with Dr. Martin Harrell out of the University of Illinois Chicago School of Medicine, College of Medicine.
Yeah.
He has 30 years of research, and what we asked him to do is really analyze it. And the number one question is, does long-term treatment of the diagnosis of schizophrenia with antipsychotic medications facilitate recovery? Well, you can imagine what he found. And he's in the process of developing four more papers, taking a look at that. And basically, to summarize, what he found is the people that were diagnosed with this label, schizophrenia, the ones that did better in the long run were the ones that never were started on medication in the first place. The ones that did second best are the ones that, of course, got just a tiny bit of medication, but it was very, very short term. The ones that did the worst were medicated long term. And so we're continuing to have him analyze his data. Bob, did you want
to? I wanted to add that one of Dr. Harrow's research partners is a neuropsychiatrist by the name of Dr. Thomas Jobe. J-O-B-E.
Let me tell folks, Bob, that they did a show a couple months ago with me. So you can, folks, you can go and look up Harrow at Bregan Podbean, or you can go to PRN-FM and get my shows, and you'll see Martin Harrow there. Go ahead.
Excellent. Yeah, I want to just put in a quick word about our continuing education course. Dr. Harrow and Dr. Jobe did one of our first courses. And I'm talking with Dr. Jobe about doing another course for us on the topic of dopamine supersensitivity. And I'm guessing that he talked a little bit about that. And I'm not a physician, so I'm not going to try to go into detail. But one of the issues that may help explain these kind of research findings is that people who get on these medications long-term actually begin to have their systems fighting back and producing more in the way of dopamine, and maybe that's an explanation for why they end up having more psychotic symptomatology over time.
Yeah, I wrote about this decades ago. The brain fights back against almost every single psychoactive substance. For example, if you smoke cigarettes and you get addicted to them, you can barely go 10 minutes without one, because the cigarettes have so changed your brain that you go into withdrawal. And the people who are out there smoking, they're not so much doing it for the joy of it as to avert withdrawal. It doesn't matter what it is, alcohol, opiates, or the psychiatric drugs, the brain fights them. And the result is the more obvious biological phenomena that if you stay on these drugs your whole life, you have almost 100% chance of developing abnormal movements, which is a part of the dopamine hypersensitivity that it develops, because it's been suppressed. It just gets more and more hyper. And the psychosis is the mental equivalent of the tardive disorder. And it was starting quite a way back. Chouinard in Canada started talking about tardive psychosis. So staying long-term on these drugs causes these reactions, which become permanent and very damaging. And also the drugs, we know more and more, this is getting more and more clear, they just simply cause atrophy of the brain. They're killing brain cells. And the atrophy starts within months. It's a serious matter. These drugs are just so toxic. They're toxic to the mitochondria. They're toxic to the whole cell. They're just very, very poisonous drugs. And by this we mean Abilify and Risperdal and Haldol. Going back would be Haldol and Thorazine and so on, but all the new ones as well. The so-called atypical antipsychotics, they're all very, very damaging to the brain. Seroquel, given to people for sleep, it's an antipsychotic of that kind. What I think should be called lobotomizing agents. Go ahead. I'm interrupting a lot here. I hope I'm not ruining your flow.
Oh, no, not at all. I'm just nodding my head, and I know people can't see that. It's interesting because Bob and I have also had personal family experience with many of these psychotropic agents that have been very, very problematic. One family member we're finally have brought back from the brink, and the other one is in a very scary place right now. So we need to continue to support each other, because this happens in hundreds of thousands of families across the United States and across the world. And to that end, we have a lot of people reaching out to us and saying, okay, in society, people follow their doctor's orders. And if a doctor tells me that I need to be on these psychotropic medications, many people follow suit. And then they wake up 10 years later, 15 years later, hopefully just a few months later, or they never get started in the first place, but they wake up and they realize that they're starting to have problems. And then they ask, how do I titrate off this medication? And there are very, very few options available when you go in and you ask a medical doctor to help you titrate off medication. Most will say, no, I can't help you do that because this medication is indicated. And so we've been asked, and we actually had a donor setting up a fund. We're just getting started, that what they want to do is research titration off certain medications so we can provide better information to people about how to do that. And of course, there's manuals already out there, but Peter, you wrote one, certainly, an excellent book. There's others that have wrote manuals, but certainly people are more interested in bringing that into the limelight with more research. So that's one of the areas, and I know you're an expert, and you can comment on that.
No, I just think it's wonderful. It's pretty sad that I've written the only textbook-like approach to this whole thing in the field. And we need more and more simple stuff. We need a variety of stuff. We need to keep reaching out to people to give them suggestions and guidance in coming off the psychiatric drugs. The most important thing is don't start them, folks. Before you start a psychiatric drug, think long and hard about it, study it. Don't be fooled into thinking there are psychiatric drugs that prevent suicide. There are no psychiatric drugs that make life better in any way. They all have blunting and disabling effects. And, of course, don't just stop them immediately on hearing a discussion like this, because they're as dangerous coming off as, and maybe sometimes worse than starting. I mean, starting can be simple compared to coming off, so... It's just
Absolutely.
A tragic situation, very tragic. I'm so glad you're dealing with all these issues. We have about 6 or 7 minutes left, so focus on anything more you want to tell about your program.
So I just want to add, we also have many more funds different peer supports. We have a fund called Intentional Peer Support. Inner Fire, you can read that on our website. Professor David Healy from across the pond also has a fund called risk.org in which you can go and record what some of your symptoms have been, because as you know, the FDA doesn't always let you know what's going on. Again, I would invite everybody to go on our website and just read the plethora of different funds that we do have. I wanted to go back for a few minutes to the Madden America Continuing Education courses because, again, Bob has really put together a remarkable list of people that are talking about it, and I wanted him to highlight a few more, if that's okay, Peter?
Sure, good.
Yeah, one of the next courses that's going to be up, I think, in the next day or two, relates to some of what we're talking about. We have a very interesting person here at the Oregon Health and Science University, and he also is at the Portland Veterans Administration. His name is Dr. Eric Turner, E-R-I-C-K, Eric Turner. And Dr. Turner is doing a course for us called Unraveling the Bundles of Research Publication Bias. Eric actually worked for the FDA, and he knows exactly the kind of information that comes to the FDA when it makes decisions. And I'm not going to get into great detail about the FDA and whether it's working for us or not, but this course will really provide some excellent background information about research publication bias. So if I can put in a plug for one of our next courses, I'm doing that. Another one of our courses relates to some of what we're talking about, and this is by a researcher in Leeuwarden, the Netherlands, and his name is Dr. Lex Wondering, and he's an MD and a PhD. And his course is entitled Prescribing Antipsychotics in First Episode Psychosis. And his question is Wes Moore. And Dr. Wunderink was with us at Yale University for a symposium that we had in symposium in April. And we had a chance to talk, and one of the things that he told me was that he went into this study expecting the opposite results. And what he found, and he'll elaborate on this in our course, is that the young people who were started on antipsychotics had about the same amount of psychotic symptomatology as people who never went on them. And where they really began to diverge were in 2 years, and the people who never had taken the antipsychotics began to show definite improvements in terms of psychotic symptomatology that the people who were staying on the so-called antipsychotic medications didn't show. And this is completely consistent, Peter, with what you've been saying for decades and what we were talking about a few minutes ago. We also have a course up by Dr. Eleanor Longman on hearing voices. So that's another thing that you'll see if you go onto our website. So I think we have a nice variety of courses. Dr. Courtney Harding, who did some of the long-term outcome research that supports all of the kind of things that we're talking about, is doing several courses for us. The first of hers is already up online, and she's going to do two more. And she'll be talking about the dozen or so research studies, many of which have been done in the UK and Western Europe, that bear all of this out as well.
I would also add we have Dr. Bonnie Kaplan from Canada, who just did a course for Mad in America on the micronutrients, use of micronutrients in helping with mental health challenges. She has also opened a donor advice fund with the foundation because she wants to do more research. She has colleagues on the East Coast as well as in New Zealand, and they're going to be doing more research on the use of micronutrients and helping with mental health challenges. We have so many things that are going on. I would also add for those of you out there that are wondering a little bit more about research, is we have a partnership group made out of researchers from many, many universities across the United States, and we're looking at starting a think tank, if you will, to really come up with projects that will be meaningful in helping to change this landscape.
We're Peter, getting down to something the, from my perspective, yep, as a former state
real
mental
quick.
Health and, I'm sorry.
Real quick.
Yeah. The challenges of changing the system are pretty amazing, and I think we're a ways away from really getting this into a situation where we're really making changes in the system. There's a lot of work to do administratively.
A lot of work. And you guys are the best. Listen, folks, you've been listening to two really marvelous people, Bob Nickel and Gina Nickel, N-I-K-K-E-L, and it's the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. It's an education just to go to their website, and on top of that, they're really lovely human beings. Thank you so much for, again, both of you, second time at least, for being on the show. Really, really appreciate
thank,
it.
Thank you, Peter, for having us. It's always good to be with you.
Thank you, Peter.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.